On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax, I'm Sue Bartholomew. You're on the Commons. And on the Commons with us today, I'm thrilled to have two people who bought the association and won because they were in the right. We have today Patrick Batt and Rudy Grom. Welcome to On the Commons, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us here.
Tell us a little bit about what's been happening. You went all the way to the Virginia Supreme Court, and the Virginia Supremes actually came down on your side. So tell us a little bit about it.
Well, Patrick and I have lived in Manchester Oaks now for over 20 years, and we're both original owners. When we first bought there, there had been only a couple houses actually sold, so the place was just beginning construction, and over the course of the next several years, the builder actually finally built all 57 units. When we both first moved there, we had read our association documents and were quite well aware of what the meaning of common area was and what our rights were as far as using the common area. And over time, as the place filled up, we were a mixture of about half and half. Our homes had garages and other half didn't. So there became kind of an issue with the non-garage owners wanting to park all the time, essentially, in front of their homes. Well, because of the place we were, because of the way we were built, we were built to the county code minimums, and that's exactly the number of common area spaces we had to meet the minimums. So the builder, at the request of some of these homeowners, actually assigned two spaces to 27 of the units, which only left 18 spaces open. At that time, Mr. Batt and I both were rather upset, so we talked to the builder, but we had the understanding that once the association took over, the actual association, that things might change and that we would actually, what we felt, comply with the state code. That actually didn't take place. We both continued to live there for a number of years. And a few things went downhill as different boards got in power, and they made it rather difficult for us to actually exist there because at one point they actually instituted a policy which limited our use to a first-come basis for the 18 what they designated as visitor spaces. And we competed essentially with all 57 homeowners and any visitors, so our rights to the common area were severely restricted.
So what's the county code? Or you said state code?
I think. Well, the county code for a development at that point was to provide 2.3 parking spaces per unit. That's just a ratio or a factor.
2.3.
So we had 57 units, and the developer had to build a complex that had 132 parking spaces. So he did that by building 30 houses with a garage, 30 houses with a driveway, which counted as 60 parking spaces, and then he put 72 spaces in the common area.
But okay. The
big difference, of course, is that the 30 garages and the 30 driveways are on private property, of which I'm an owner.
And you paid extra for?
There was a slight differential in the initial cost, ranging, depending upon, of course, the market. It ranged somewhere in the vicinity of $6,000 to $10,000, paying for a house that had a garage compared to one that maybe had a fourth bedroom or a family room.
And that's the case that I think everybody in our community benefited from, that from the fact that Fairfax County allowed the developer to count the driveway and the garages as parking spaces, because that let him build more houses and to make the houses more affordable for the people that wanted to live there, such as ourselves. He had to build, the county code says that so many spaces have to be built. does not say anything about the ownership of those spaces, and it does not say that any particular unit is required to have 2.3 parking spaces, which some of our non-garage units neighbors thought that, well, since you have your two spaces in your garage and your driveway, then we get two spaces in the parking area for our exclusive use. And that was kind of the basis of our lawsuit, was that we said common area, the basic meaning of common area, and in fact the definition of common area in Black's Law, is that it's equally owned by everyone in the community. And that's always what we maintained, was we were equal owners of the common area, that when people bought in Manchester Oaks, our neighborhood, they bought a lot, which was a piece of property, and either a 3 or 4 bedroom townhouse with or without a garage. The 4 bedroom townhouses didn't have a garage, but everyone owned the common area equally. And ultimately, that's what the Supreme Court ruled. When we went to the Supreme Court, one of the justices pulled out his copy of Black's Law and said, let me read you the definition of common area. Common area is equally owned. And how is it that you think that you can deny people that equally own a piece of property and equal access to that property? And they said, well, we're the board, and we think that we can do that. And that, of course, was unfortunately part of the problem, is that our board, which was composed always of a majority of non-garage owners, wanted to sort of bully through their personal agenda to acquire parking spaces. And that's what the president of the board said at one point. He said, my mission is to gain these parking spaces for the non-garage units.
But you also had Southeast Station, that is another lawsuit in Virginia, where they essentially dealt with the same issues, and the owners won there, the non-garage owners or the garage owners. It was essentially the same issue, wasn't it?
Sully Station was very similar to us. In fact, that's what kind of first piqued our interest after we heard about this case. I guess the case was somewhere around 2000, and I think I first heard about it in late 2001. And Pat and I at that time approached our board and said, you know, we believe we're very similar to this, and this case pretty much proves that what you're doing is not right. And we actually, at that time, we were not on the board, but got the board to seek legal opinion, and they did that. And a couple months later, a firm gave them a written statement. And, of course, when they got the results, I think they were quite surprised, and we said we'd like to see it. And they said, no, that's attorney-client privilege, and we're not going to let you see it. And we said, well, that we pretty much think that since we paid for it, we think we'd like to see it. And they, of course, said no. And we said, well, we pretty much think what it says confirms our suspicions. And at that point, we let it drop until about a year or so later, Pat and I both got on the board and, of course, had access to the document.
Ah. And what did the document say? Were right.
It was an opinion from a reputable legal firm, and pretty much confirmed that the policy, or absolutely confirmed the policy they had in place, was not enforceable under the terms of our declaration and the Property Owners Act.
But they went ahead anyway.
And that kind of the problem was they kept going ahead and doing everything to use our money to stretch out this case. Among other things, at one point, the Homeowners Association entered a plea for a demurrer, which meant just dismiss the charges. And when they went to the judge in Fairfax County Circuit Court, he told the Homeowners Association that this was exactly like Sully Station, and why were they even bothering to come and bother him with this case? And they explained that our case was different than Sully Station, that in our case, the declaration said that the Homeowners Association, the board, had the right to assign a maximum of 2 reserved parking spaces in the common area to each lot. And the judge said, each lot. And the Homeowners Association attorney said, right, And that means that we can assign 0, 1, or 2 spaces to any particular lot. And the judge said, boy, you're going to get slam dunked with that argument. It's a guaranteed loser. And he presented a case to them. He said, I recommend that you review this case, and it's going to explain why it is that you're going to lose. And, in fact, the case that he showed them was it was a Loudon opinion, but it very clearly said why they were going to lose because of this principle that common area is equally owned by all owners, and therefore all owners have an equal right to the common area. The unfortunate thing with our homeowners association is they kept using our resources to stretch this case out as long as they could. And I think what they thought was, if we make this expensive enough, they're going to have to eventually give up.
Well, it is economic warfare. It always is in these instances because they've got the money, your money, basically, and they're going to just keep squeezing until you say, I quit. You win. Okay, the parking spots were one part of your case. The other one was whether or not you were entitled under the Virginia Property Owners Association Act as the winning party to get fees and costs and fees, and you were. The judges said, the Supreme Court said you were, right? You were awarded all of that.
They definitely did. When you take a look at that provision in the Property Owners Act, the wording starts out by saying each lot that is subject to this declaration. Well, their, let's just say, strained interpretation was that only the lots were subject to the declaration, not the board of directors or not the association. So their interpretation was that since we initiated the lawsuit, that even though we were the prevailing party, we were not entitled to recovery of our legal fees. And that, of course, is not the way the Supreme Court eventually ruled, because it had ruled several times prior to this in other homeowner cases where the homeowners had initiated a lawsuit and were the prevailing party, and that's exactly what they cited as the reason they were entitled to legal fees. We found that to be a very interesting argument that they would actually pursue thinking that the association was not subject to the very document that created it and gave it its power, that somehow only the owners are subject to that document.
Yeah. I read the case. I've got it. In fact, I've got my computer here with the case in case we needed to look anything up. But the argument that they came up with for not awarding you the fees and costs is the same argument that they've used in the Ferran case, and they've lost in the Short case, and they've lost. And these attorneys come in, and it's the same argument all the time. And it just doesn't get them anywhere. You'd think that they'd get smart and stop.
Well, in our case, the Supreme Court said that they had ruled before in White versus Boundary that the whites were entitled to their attorney's fees. And what they said in our case is, let us now make explicit what we formerly made implicit in the White case, that if one side can collect attorney's fees, then the other side has to be able to collect attorney's fees. I mean, already the Homeowners Association, it has all of your resources and it has the resources of other people, so you're already out kind of gunned by them because they have more resources than yours. And if they can collect their legal fees when they win, but you can't collect your legal – a homeowner cannot collect his legal fees when he wins – then he can never go to court. He doesn't have equal protection under the law. And I think that was an important part of our case is that they made this explicit and said, listen, if one side gets attorney's fees, then the other side gets attorney's fees. And, of course, homeowners can collect attorney's fees if they win. If a homeowner enters on a quixotic, Don Quixote kind of case, and tries to make his homeowners association abide by their own rules, and he's successful in doing that, then he ought to be able to collect his legal fees, his attorney's fees.
In some states, they have a multiplier, and I know that doesn't apply in Virginia, or certainly not in your case, but if you get an attorney who takes the case pro bono and it's an improbable case to win, and they win, and they win big, I've seen where the judges have given them a multiplier. What would your fee have been had you been collecting from the homeowner? And if it was $100,000, well, we're going to give you a multiplier of 3. So you collect $300 from the association. So, but a lot of states don't have the winner takes all, like we do in Virginia. That's a very important thing that we have, because, as you say, you couldn't take your association to court if you didn't have a chance of recouping your money.
And in our case, we would have been glad if the Homeowners Association would have agreed to go for summary judgment. That would have been much cheaper for everyone. But in our case, the legal strategy of the Homeowners Association appeared to be to make this as expensive and prolonged and as long as possible. And I think that that was recognized by some of the judges that was recognized by judges in the Fairfax County Circuit Court that said the dilatory tactics of the Homeowners Association had raised the cost of this case. And that was also recognized by the Virginia Supreme Court that also said that part of, in awarding us our attorney's fees and awarding us all of our attorney's fees, said that part of the reason our attorney's fees were so high was because of the dilatory tactics that were employed by the Homeowners Association and perhaps dishonest tactics that were employed by them as well.
How long did the case, how many years were you in court?
I think we actually filed the first paperwork sometime around April of 2009, and then we actually got the final ruling from the Virginia Supreme Court on September of last year, 2012. So the whole thing lasted just over 3 years between, roughly 8 or 9 different sections in Fairfax County Court, then followed by the delay of about 6 months to a year while they went with the appeal to the Supreme Court, and that whole process itself took about 9 to 10 months to complete through the Supreme Court, which we were pretty happy was, I guess, actually somewhat quick. So we're pretty happy with the results.
Yeah. Well, yeah, congratulations on the results. That's neat. You talk about neighborhoods and it's really sad that you have to do that. I mean, you went in with the Sully case. You asked them to get an opinion. They got an opinion. Why do you think associations typically don't try to be even-handed, fair, and play by the rules? What is it? Why do we end up in court? Either one of you, you can both answer that.
In our case, there is a distinct perception that because you bought a house with a garage, and you'll see it in a number of communities, they actually try to put it into their rules that you must park in your garage or you must park in your driveway. Now, that's almost the same as saying you must sleep in your bedroom every night or you must use your bedroom as a bedroom, not as a library or something. There seems to be this distinction that a garage and a driveway have to be used for parking and that they have somehow in some way been disadvantaged because of their choosing to buy a house without a garage, therefore they have a greater entitlement to the common area. And I think that this is a common perception in communities such as ours, whereas this mixed type of development with garages and non-garages. And, of course, like I said earlier, we were built to the absolute minimum Fairfax County code. So there were no extra spaces, whereas in a number of communities where there is extra land, a developer may have 10, 15, 20 additional parking spaces, so there isn't quite that problem. But being built to the minimum, and as we all know, a requirement of 2.3 parking spaces per house that has three or four bedrooms. You've got the teenage children, a mom and dad both may have a car, even a company car. You generally have well over two cars per household.
Yeah. No, I live in a townhouse as well where we have the same problem, except that mine's an older one, and it was 1.7, I think, the county code. So that's a huge, huge problem.
When we talked to our neighbors, we tried to explain to them that, as I said before, they got a fourth bedroom out of not having a garage. And, in fact, when the guy, our developer, developed our neighborhood, he didn't call that a fourth bedroom. He very carefully called that a den. In the meantime, most of those townhouses have turned that den into a fourth bedroom. And nobody says that they can't turn their den into mm-hmm. a fourth bedroom, although it may violate county fire code. But by the same token, these same people, because they'd like to have two parking spaces, and I don't blame them, I'd like to have two parking spaces too, insist that we use our garage as a place to park a car. Well, in my neighborhood, some people have turned their garage into a woodworking shop. One guy turned his garage into a kind of small gym for himself. One guy liked model airplanes, so he kind of turned his garage into a hangar. People move in and they have a lot of things that they want to store, so they store things in their garage. There's a lot of different things that people could use the interior space of their house for, even if it was designed as a garage. And somehow that's not okay to the non-garage owners, although it's okay with them that they have a fourth bedroom. They don't see, I don't know, it's kind of the way that people look at things. They're looking at things for their advantage, and I will say that when the developer originally developed the place, as Rudy said, at some point he started assigning reserved parking spaces in the common area to some units, and they're utterly convinced that that's their parking spaces and that those spaces were conveyed with their house. And we said, oh, really? Do you have any kind of documentation for that? Well, no, they didn't have any documentation for that, but yeah. They were their spaces. It's they were conveyed yeah. with their house.
It's an interesting point that you bring up because you've got the interior space. You can use it any way you want. And the people with the den can use it as a bedroom or a den or an office or a gym or anything. But you should be able to use that same, your garage the same way. Yet you're being told you have to use it for parking.
Well, they officially couldn't tell us that or put it in a document, but that's their impression that we should do that. And in fact, mm-hmm. There was a recent article by another homeowners association where it went on to say what is a good neighbor, and a couple of the quotes were, a good neighbor is someone who parks their car in their garage and parks their car in their driveway and leaves the visitor spaces open for the visitors. Well, what's unique is the fact the word visitor doesn't even exist in our document.
Yeah.
So the fact that we have visitor parking spaces has always been somewhat a bit of contention for me because our president, who was on the board when this all got started, he had oftentimes told us that I was the biggest violator in the community because I often parked my car in the visitor space, and everybody knows I'm not a visitor. Well, I just often said, we can change that word, but he said, oh, no, that's got to be a visitor space. So you can see his mindset was that, reserve spaces for the units without garages and everything else is a visitor, and at one point was actually talking about trying to say that visitors were for visitors only and that owners could not park there. Well, that didn't sit well with me, and that's part of what got a lot of this going back in early 2009.
So let me jump in a little bit, and I assume that your listeners or some of your listeners will say, well, why are those people so greedy? They have two parking spaces, and they should use the two parking spaces they have. Why do they want to use the common area space? And the problem is, as I discussed with our developer after he had left and went to visit his brother, is that if you park one car in the garage, usually a car is used by a person. My wife parks her car in the garage. She likes to park her car in the garage. I park behind her in the driveway a lot of the time, most of the time. Well, then that means that if she wants to leave and go somewhere, I have to be home or available so that I can move my car out of the way so that she can unpark, and then I have to be available when she returns so that she can repark inside the garage. So I got to shuffle my car. If I'm not there, then she's got to get in my car, park it in the street, and by the way, she doesn't like to drive my car, and I used to have a shift car that she could not drive, but she has to get in my car, she has to move it into the street or go park it somewhere because all the curbs in our neighborhood are yellow. You're not allowed to park next to the curb. She has to find a parking space, park my car, get her car out, go park her car in a parking space, and then return my car to the garage. Well, that's kind of like, it's a big hassle to have to shuffle your car. I don't think most people mind parking a car in their driveway or their garage. But I think a lot of couples object to having to park both in their driveway and their garage. And in fact, the people that live on our side of the development that are garage units, I would say none of them regularly park their car both in the garage and the driveway. They will generally park one car in the garage or one car in the driveway and park the other car in the common area parking, which what kind of like ticked me off and got us interested in doing this. For a long time, we went to the Homeowners Association and we said, look, your parking policy in the common area is unfair. It's not legal. Your parking policy is unfair. It's not legal. We don't get an equal right to this. And they kind of just blew us off. So eventually, out of desperation, we had to go see a lawyer. The lawyer wrote him a letter and said, look, this is the reasons why your parking policy violates state law. And he cited the Sully case, the Sully Station case, and he cited the White v. Boundary case. And we sent that letter to the Homeowners Association, and they ignored it. So
yeah.
Eventually, we had no choice but to take them to court. One thing I would say is, if you're in a homeowners association and it gets a letter from a lawyer, you probably should not ignore that letter. You might want to respond to that letter. But they didn't. What bothered me
about... They didn't even bother to respond.
Oh, no.
They just blew it off totally.
They just blew it off totally. So the next thing we had to do is take them to court. And what really bothered me was I would come home at night. I come home late, so I would come home late at night. And I'd have to park my car on the street or park my car on the other side of the development. Many times I parked on the street, and I'd walk back to my house past a half a dozen empty parking spaces because it made this assignment of two spaces to all these units, all these non-garage units. And in the non-garage units, there were single people that lived, so that never parked in the second space. So for years, there were spaces that were never parked in. And that kind of encouraged me, I think encouraged us, to try and pursue this. But just as much as possible, our Homeowners Association just ignored us and blew us off.
You're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and we're sitting here talking to Rudy Gum and also to Pat Batt. That's a mouthful.
Yeah.
And they just won the Manchester Oaks case, which is on my website on thecommons.us if you want to go read it for yourselves. And in case you're wondering about what Pat was talking about, why would he not be home if his car was in the driveway? Well, because in the Washington area, a lot of people use public transportation because our roads are packed and we've got the worst traffic jams in the country. For, the third year in a row, parking downtown, if you have to go downtown, is impossible. So it makes life extremely difficult when you have a situation like that. And I'm so glad you explained that, because I know a lot of people are sitting there thinking, he shouldn't be doing that. I mean, that's really not fair. He's very greedy, isn't he? But I've seen managers who actually wanted to be able to come into your garage and inspect it to make sure that you weren't storing junk in there because they wanted you to park your car in there.
what you've hit on is a very critical point, because there actually are communities where the developers have agreed to that kind of language going into their declarations. Now, the big difference there is those words are actually in the declaration up front, and you really need to read them and understand them when you buy your unit. If it says that the garage shall be primarily used for parking, and in some cases can never be modified so that a car cannot be parked in there, then you're pretty much bound by your declaration, because the declaration is generally a very good document, and it does set the boundaries for what can be done in your community. And if that's the way it's worded up front, you really need to read and understand those words. And a lot of people, of course, they get those documents before they buy their house, and how many of them actually read them? And only later do they actually read them and come to find out that maybe you're only allowed to have one dog. Or maybe you can't modify your house the way you want to because there's architectural guidelines. So a lot of people seem to ignore their documents and just assume that, well, I'm in a community, no big deal. I'll do as I please until something like this arises. And it really gets their attention quickly.
Well, the documents sometimes are given to them at the last minute, and they've already sold one house, and everything they own is on the moving van, and they're headed to closing. Because I've had people call me and say, I was just handed these documents. Do I have to abide by them? What do I do now? And I say, yeah, you've got to abide by them, but you've got 72 hours in Virginia to cancel the sale. If you don't want to live there, do that. But they don't, because what are they going to do with their truck full of stuff? You know, they can't live on the street. They won't be shuffling cars back and forth like you do. But so it is a problem, I think. It's a huge problem. And you're absolutely right, because if you go to court, the judge is going to say, hey, it says so right here. You agree to it. You signed the paper. It's part of the contract.
I think that's what one of the Virginia is very clear on that with the establishment of homeowner associations, in particular in Fairfax County, where a lot of this is clearly spelled out either in the county code or, and it was also backed up in the State Property Owners Act, to where the document is a legal document basically, and it's filed with the county land records. And call it what you like, it's essentially a contract that you've agreed to abide by living there. You have to be a member. It's mandated that you pay the association fees and that you live by the rules. And I don't think Pat or I have ever had a problem with that, because the declaration has sort of been our best friend, because we read it and we understood it. And when in doubt, we did seek legal counsel. And, of course, so did our association. They just decided that they didn't want to follow counsel. At one point, our president actually said that, you know, legal opinion is just that. It's an opinion. If you want the true answer, you have to go to court. Well, that's where we ended up.
But I think you make a really good point here, Shu, and I think the point to learn here, I didn't realize when we moved into our association that you were going to – I did read the declaration, but – I didn't realize the implications of that. Well, I guess I did, but what I would advise anybody that's going to buy a home in a homeowners association, first of all, if you're going to buy a home, ask, is it in a homeowners association? And if it is in a homeowners association, then where are the governing documents? And I would read those governing documents before I made the offer on the house. I would also want to know what kind of financial shape the homeowners association was in. Do they have, what's the reserve study say about the depreciation of their common area elements, and what kind of finances does the homeowners association have to be paying off those obligations that they have? And you need to do that like way up front before you get in this situation where you've got your stuff on a moving truck and somebody hands you this 1-inch packet and says, here, read this over while you're driving into your new home. That's the bad situation to be in.
You know, some of the documents, some of the packets are really, really thick, especially when you end up in situations where you have master associations and then you have cluster associations, and we don't have them yet, or they're starting to come in Virginia, But then you have things like CDDs. These are development districts that are another layer of government. So you end up with three layers of documents, and some of them are the size of a Washington, D.C. phone book. It's impossible to read and absorb all of that. It's really, really difficult.
Well, that is exactly the situation we're in, because as we're a small homeowners or property owners association of only 57 units, but we're part of a larger master association that does have 10 individual neighborhoods in it.
Okay, so you do have a master association.
We have a master association, and generally the master association is responsible for the common area elements that are kind of intermingled throughout the different neighborhoods, plus the recreation facilities such as the tennis courts, basketball courts, and the swimming pool. So it's a pretty clear distinction between what each association is responsible for. However, like you were saying, to some it's quite confusing, and in our case, we only pay one monthly assessment fee, which is common throughout all 10 neighborhoods. So a lot of people don't realize they're even a member of two different associations, essentially, and don't know what you're talking about when you talk about the master association. And although that really is not, you know, pertinent to our case here, but it's a very common and confusing thing to a lot of homeowners.
So it was your homeowner association, your cluster association that you sued, and not necessarily the master association.
Oh, exactly. Yes, it was just our smaller homeowner property owners association, and we had 57 units.
But it does get confusing.
Well, it gets confusing, and in our case, the disclosure package is probably an inch and a half or an inch and three quarters thick, and I know that that's a lot of work to go through and read that. But there is no question that if I bought into a homeowners association again, I would read that with great detail. It's just part of the homework you got to do. I mean, it's confusing. When we bought our house, we hadn't bought a house before, so it was confusing. All the, here, sign this. I mean, all these papers they were giving you.
Oh, yeah. It takes an hour.
Yes.
At least. I used to sell real estate. I know what we put you through. I know what it's like. Yeah, and, you know, sometimes realtors are afraid that you're going to back out, so they don't hand you the documents when they should. We went to Florida, and I went to Celebration, because I like going there and checking them out, their model development. And I looked at the housing, and I wanted to know if there was a homeowners association. I knew there was. And I said, could I see the documents? And they said, yes, sign a contract. And I said, how do I know if I want to sign a contract? They offered to show me the restrictions. And I said, they pulled out a couple of pages out of a drawer. And I said, those are the documents as recorded in the land records, right? These are the documents. No, these are from the documents that are recorded in the land records. I go, no. I want them as recorded. No. You can't have them as recorded. You sign a contract first. And right. But they showed me the door. They did not want me there. When I asked if there was a CDD and if I could have some information on that, please, they showed me the door. They said, get out of here. We don't want you.
Well, that's quite unfortunate, and you know, hopefully a lot of associations don't operate that way, because they should be encouraging, you know, buyers, because it's good to have houses sell relatively quickly instead of having for sale signs out front. And so far it's been sort of interesting for us, being in a lawsuit for this long, that we've had about a half a dozen homes actually sell throughout this lawsuit. So I don't exactly know what some of these new buyers were thinking when they were told a lawsuit was ongoing, that there might be a special assessment, because it became apparent early on that the association was running up some pretty sizable legal bills and had completely exhausted our reserve fund, which would be a whole separate topic of discussion because you really shouldn't dip into your reserves to pay operating costs. But they went ahead and did that, and that was quickly exhausted, and then just continued to run up debt, which put all the homeowners in a very precarious position at that point, because that was long before the end of the case and the fact that we then were the prevailing parties and won our legal fees.
How much were those legal fees?
Well, we had to sort of negotiate an amount in court, but we were nearly awarded 100% of our fees, which at that time were $188,000. And then when the association filed their appeal with the state court, that, of course, cost us nearly another $30,000 to fight the appeal to the Supreme Court. And when we won pretty much hands down in the Supreme Court, we had to go back to Fairfax County, which awarded us 100% of that money. So our total legal fees in this lawsuit are about $220,000 at this point.
Wow, because I have the Supreme Court ruling here, and it was like 188. You were telling me earlier that every homeowner was awarded something like 70,000. Can Rudy, you were saying that?
Well, that's kind of a separate issue because during the lawsuit, the association filed for bankruptcy, and as part of the bankruptcy, then any creditor is entitled to file a claim against the association. So at this point, a number of the non-garage owners have filed claims, and the bankruptcy is not completed yet, so we don't know what the final outcome of that will be.
But the reason for the claim being that the house is worth more, or they were – I know there was some confusing stuff about how much the parking spaces were worth and added value to the houses, to the non-garage houses.
These are claims by non-garage owners that say that their housing has been depreciated. But that part of our case is under appeal in the bankruptcy court. So that's not quite resolved yet.
So that, okay. Now there was a third plaintiff in the case, James Martin. And his situation was a little different because he didn't buy in the thing, but he was awarded because based on taxes he was paying.
Well, yeah, James.
An interesting twist.
Yes, he. I can't remember the exact year, but I think it was around 2006 when he bought. And of course, the policy of the reserved spaces was already in effect. But since there was really no documentation given to him, he, like anyone else, assumed that one of the spaces would at least be for him, but it wasn't. So he joined the lawsuit because he felt that he had been misled or had misrepresentation made to him because he believed that he was entitled, like us, to use of the common area. So he joined the lawsuit, but since it was an entirely different situation for him, we were all awarded basically a smaller amount for being denied the use of the space, yet paying the full assessment for the entire time we lived there. So the Supreme Court came to the final ruling that we would be compensated for, I think the amount was something like $15 for every month that we had lived there and were denied parking. And since he was only there for about 3 years, his amount was less. And we actually had lived there since 1990 through 2009. So we had, and it's all got started about 1996. So we had 13 years times $15 a month, which is what the court awarded us for our inconvenience, let's say.
For your inconvenience. But that's money you were paying that you weren't getting anything for.
Absolutely.
Rudy and I bought our homes before there was a discriminatory parking policy, and the court recognized that we didn't have a chance to we bought our homes before they had this parking policy in place, and they said, well, James Martin had bought his home after this parking policy was in place, but we estimated that the cost of maintaining the parking spaces was about $15 a month, from our homeowners' fees, and we weren't getting any use out of that $15 a month. And the court recognized that that was a legitimate claim that we had, that we'd been paying for something that we couldn't use. James kind of went into this a little backwards. He said, well, if you figure out how much taxes I'm paying on the square feet within my lot, it's so much money, and then there's so much per square foot, and then if you take that so much per square foot times the parking spaces, you come up with a figure of what the parking space would be worth and what it could rent for, what it could reasonably rent for.
It's what, $37 a month or
$37.50 a month, but I think the court said, well, that's an interesting argument, but we don't buy it. And I'm not actually sure they understood it. They didn't buy that. They bought the $15.
I think they bought the $15 a month that was coming out of his assessments, that he wasn't getting the same
and
use.
Ours.
Yes.
Okay, because I saw a grand total. It was like that, and I'm going, oh, good.
Yeah, there were a number of confusing issues here because in court we really weren't claiming an extensive amount of damages, although we feel we were damaged while we were being denied the space, but it was hard to put a dollar value on that. And what was cited was the fact that the board created a website and they put the value of a parking space on the website.
Yeah, I read that.
And they boldly said that that the loss of a parking space to a homeowner would be somewhere between $20,000 and $50,000 per parking space. Now, it's going to be difficult to describe how they came up with that number, but that is what our judge originally used in Fairfax County in determining that we were going to be entitled to some compensation. And she felt, the judge felt that we had been denied the use of parking and that we should have been entitled to one space. So she took the lower end and originally awarded us $25,000 in compensatory damages. But when it went to the Supreme Court, since they hadn't ruled yet, but they kind of said, if you're getting your parking spaces back, you really have no loss. So although you lost the use for a number of years, you now have the space back, so you're not entitled to $25,000 in damages.
Oh, really? So all those years that you were paying for it, that was just wiped out?
Well, they did give us the $15 a month.
They did.
That we'd been paying for the maintenance of an asset that we couldn't use. So they gave us the $15 a month, but they didn't give us the $25,000 diminution of value. Because they said you never sold your house, so you didn't really suffer a diminution of value because you never sold your house.
Interesting arguments and interesting opinions that have come out. You never went into this for the money, though. You just wanted to be able to use those empty parking spaces that you weren't allowed to use.
Well, that was a big part of it. We were sort of, as I talked about a little earlier, we were getting kind of squeezed by the board at that time by the simple fact that they instituted this policy that limited us to one hang tag. So that clearly meant that if I have two vehicles and I'm using my garage for something else, at best I can park one in my driveway and one in the common area. So then the argument of me having a visitor pretty much goes out the window because I'm using my visitor pass on a daily basis just to park my second vehicle. And that we really also had argument or discussion a number of times with our president where he really believed that the visitor spaces should be visitor only and that an owner shouldn't park there. And that pretty much put both of us over the edge.
To me, it was a simple matter of justice that it's very clear in our declaration and in our deeds that we bought a lot and an equal share of the common area. And if we owned an equal share of the common area, then we should have an equal right to use the common area. And we were being denied our equal use of the common area. I mean, it's not very complicated. It's a pretty simple argument. And the declaration, in my mind, is very clear. It says you can make an assignment of parking to each lot. It doesn't say some lots. It doesn't say the lots that you choose. It says each lot. And maybe a mistake or that the Homeowners Association made when they went to the Supreme Court is one of the justices said, so you're saying you can assign parking as you want. Does that mean that you could have five of your friends and you could assign all the parking to your five friends? And the Homeowners Association said, yes, we can assign all the parking to our five friends. And the justice said, I don't think that sounds very fair or equal. Again, he pulls out his pocket edition of Black's Law and says, common means equal. It doesn't mean that you can assign the commonly owned assets to your five friends.
There's a question in here. I mean, they're actually licensing. And I know in Sully Station it said that, or what was it, Boundary, it said that they didn't have the right. There's nothing in the governing documents allowing them to license the common areas. And I think that's probably in White.
I think the White and Boundary one was where that got into the idea of licensing a space, and they were not authorized to do that. Both Sully Station and the White and Boundary case, you know, are nearly identical to ours. It's just that each of us have slightly different words in our declaration, but the bottom line is the concept of what the document says about the use of common area. And ours was very straightforward. There were no real exceptions that allowed them to do something in a preferential or discriminatory fashion.
So what's it like now in your neighborhood? Can you, any assigned spaces? Are they all unassigned, first come, first served, visitor? What's the deal?
At this point, all the parking spaces are unassigned, and the Homeowners Association, which is a new board, has a new board now, is working on a parking policy. And the parking policy that they proposed so far is that every unit would be assigned one parking space, whether you have a garage or don't have a garage. And as Rudy says, there's nothing in our declaration that discriminates or makes any mention of any difference between garage and non-garage units. It talks about lots, each lot. So their current plan is to assign each lot a parking space. And I think that things are quiet in our neighborhood. People have asked me sometimes, well, do your neighbors hate you now? And are you afraid to walk out of your house? And we don't find that, I don't think. There's not any hostility from
That's unusual. Neighbors. That's unusual. But that's good.
Well, it's good, and part of the reason behind this is I think a lot of the neighbors never really did get involved. The whole time the lawsuit was ongoing, next to no one came to board meetings. The board wasn't telling them much because, of course, their impression at a board meeting was that every time they came back from court is they had won. And, in fact, they actually, I guess, believed that the Supreme Court was going to completely overturn the Fairfax County Court ruling, but in my mind, at least, they put a major exclamation point on what Fairfax County had said about common area, and we even touched upon the fact that our association tried to do an amendment to the declaration, which they didn't do very well, and part of that wasn't even challenged in the Supreme Court, so that the whole idea or concept that they had amended the declaration was completely wiped out by the Supreme Court. And we were rather quite pleased from Fairfax County when our judge upheld the fact that, well, yes, the declaration can be amended if you go through the proper process, and it should be laid out in the declaration, but that when you amend something, the essentially the new or the amended words can't conflict with other parts that are already in the declaration. Yeah. Because, you know, we bought under the terms that common area is for the equal or common use of all the people, and all of a sudden we've got an amendment that says we've got this special or reserved common area that's only for some people. And the judge said, I don't think that's quite right, because now you have conflict within the same document. And basically they didn't challenge that at the Supreme Court, so that was upheld.
Some of the documents that one of the reasons that the amendment was overturned by the Fairfax County Circuit Court was that the president had written a letter to the homeowners that she found were contained false information, inflammatory information, and in fact he said that if you didn't vote for this amendment, then you were going to get stuck with a $15,000 bill per unit. And what didn't say is, oh, by the way, you're probably getting stuck with a bill anyway because we're fighting this court case. But again, I would advise your listeners to pay attention to, if you live in a homeowners association, then you really kind of got to pay attention to what's going on in that homeowners association. That, as Rudy said, all the time this was going on, most of our neighbors didn't really pay much attention to what was happening while the homeowners association, the board, was running up these exorbitant bills and had very little likelihood of prevailing. But most of our neighbors just didn't pay very much attention to that. And I can understand that. People have kids. They have their jobs. They want to live someplace. They don't want to be distracted or be bothered going to homeowners meetings, which are pretty boring. Having been on the board, I can guarantee they're pretty boring.
Oh, I've been there too. Yeah.
But you have to, if your home is your most important and significant investment. And if you live in a homeowners association, you have certain rights and obligations by being in that homeowners association, and you really need to pay attention to them. And in this case, where the board kind of had one side of an opinion, it would have been good for the neighbors to maybe inform themselves of the other side of that opinion, because whereas, like Rudy said, they were absolutely convinced they were right.
Oh yeah.
But if you read the court cases, if you read Sully v. Dye, or you read White v. Boundary, or you read the other Lorton case, you'd say, or you'd read what our lawyer wrote, you'd say, these people seem to have a pretty good case here.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in. We're out of time. Would you believe the hour's gone by?
Oh, good. I got that. So my advice, I got it just at the right time.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.